Cornish Piskies, the mischievous fair folk native to the area. Emma wondered how much the locals believed in them. Not as much as they should, she suspected. They ordered Coke and fries for Julian, sandwich and lemonade for Emma, and Julian spread his map out over the table. His phone was next to it. He flipped through the photos he'd been taking with one hand, poking at the map with the other. Smears of colored pencil decorated his hand, familiar smudges of blue and yellow and green. "The east side of the harbor is called the Warren," he said. "Lots of houses, and a lot of them are old, but most of them are rented out now to tourists. And none of them are on top of any caves. That leaves the area around Polperro and to the west." Their food had arrived. Emma started wolfing her sandwich. She hadn't realized how hungry she was. "What's this?" she asked, pointing at the map.
"That's Chapel Cliff, love," said the waitress, setting down Emma's drink. She pronounced it Chapel. "Start of the coastal path. From there, you can walk all the way to Foy."
She glanced over at the bar where two tourists had just sat down.
"Oi, be right there."
"How do you find the path?" Julian said. "If we were to walk it today, where would we start?"
"Oh, it's a long way to Foy," said the waitress. "But the path starts up behind the Blue Peter Inn."
She pointed out the window across the harbor.
"There's a walking trail that goes up the hill. You turn onto the coastal path at the old net loft. It's all broken down now, but you'll see it easy. It's just above the caves."
Emma raised her eyebrows.
"The caves?"
The waitress laughed.
"The old smuggler's caves," she said. "I guess you came in at high tide, didn't you? Or you'd have seen them for sure."
Emma and Julian exchanged a single look before scrambling to their feet. Heedless of the waitress's startled protests, they spilled out into the street beside the inn. She'd been right, of course. The tide had come down, and the harbor looked very different now. The boats beached on rises of muddy sand. Behind the harbor rose a narrow spit of land, shingled with gray rocks. It was easy to see why it was called Chapel Cliff. The spit was tipped with gray rocks, which twisted narrowly up into the air like the spires of a church cathedral. The water had lowered enough so that a great deal of the cliff was revealed. The sea had been pounding against the rocks when they'd arrived. Now it sloshed quietly in the harbor, retreating to reveal a small, sandy beach, and behind it the dark openings of several cave mouths. Above the caves, perched on the steep slope of the cliff, was a house. Emma had barely spared it a glance when they had first arrived. It had simply been one of many small houses that dotted the side of the harbor across from the Warren, though she could see now that it was farther out along the spit of land than any of the others. In fact, it was quite distant from them, standing small and alone between the sea and sky. Its windows were boarded up. Its whitewash had peeled away in gray strips. But if Emma looked with her shadow hunter eyes, she could see more than an abandoned house. She could see the white lace curtains in the windows and new shingles on the roof. There was a mailbox nailed to the fence. A name was painted onto the box in sloppy white letters barely visible from this distance. They certainly wouldn't have been visible to a mundane, but Emma could see them. Fade. Chapter 18. Memories of the Past. Gia Penhollow was seated behind the desk in the consul's office, illuminated by the rays of the sun over Alicante. The spires of the demon towers glittered outside the window, red, gold, and orange, like shards of bloody glass. She had the same warmth in her face Diana remembered, but she looked as if much more time had passed since the dark war than 5 years. There was white in her black hair, which was pinned up elegantly on the top of her head. "It's good to see you, Diana," she said, inclining her head toward the chair opposite her desk. "We've all been very curious about your mysterious news." "I imagine," Diana sat down. "But I was hoping what I had to say would stay between the two of us." Gia didn't look surprised. Not that she would show it if she was.
"I see. I'd wondered if you'd come about the Los Angeles Institute head position. I assume you'd want to take over now that Arthur Blackthorne is dead."
Her graceful hands fluttered as she shuffled and stacked papers, slotted pens into their holders. It was very brave of him to approach the convergence alone. I was sorry to hear he was slain.
Diana nodded. For reasons none of them knew, Arthur's body had been found near the destroyed convergence site, covered in blood from his cut throat and in stains of ichor that Julian told her grimly were Malcolm's blood. There was no reason to contradict the official assumption that he had waged a solo assault on the convergence and been killed by Malcolm's demons.
At least Arthur would be remembered as brave, though it gave her a pang that he had been burned and buried without his nieces and nephews there to mourn him. That in fact no one in the wider world would know he had sacrificed himself for his family. Livy had said to her that she hoped they would be able to have a remembrance ceremony for him when they all went to Idris. Diana hoped so, too.
Gia didn't seem nonplussed by Diana's silence. "Patrick remembers Arthur from when they were boys," she said, "though I'm afraid I never knew him. How are the children coping?"
"The children? How did you explain that the Blackthorns' second father had been their older brother since he was 12 years old? That Julian and Emma and Mark weren't children at all, really, having suffered enough for most adults' entire lifetimes. That Arthur Blackthorne had never really run the Institute, and the whole idea that he needed to be replaced was like an elaborate and terrible joke."
"The children are devastated," Diana said. "Their family has been fragmented, as you know. What they want is to return to Los Angeles, their home."
"But they cannot return while there is no one to head the Institute, which is why I thought you..."
"I don't want it to be me," Diana said. "I'm not here to ask for that job. But neither do I want it to go to Zara Dearborn and her father."
"Really?" said Gia. Her tone was neutral, but her eyes glittered with interest. "If not the Dearborns and not you, then who?"
"If Helen Blackthorne was allowed to return..."
Gia sat up straight.
"And run the Institute? You know the Council would never allow..."
"Then let Aline run the Institute," said Diana. "Helen could simply remain in Los Angeles as her wife, and be with her family."
Gia's expression was calm, but her hands gripped the desk tightly.
"Aline is my daughter. You think I don't want to bring her home?"
"I've never known what you thought," Diana said. It was true. She had no children. But if it had been her sister who had been exiled, she couldn't imagine not fighting tooth and claw to have her released.
"When Helen was first exiled, and Aline chose to go with her, I thought about resigning as consul," said Gia, her hand still taut. "I knew I had no power to reverse the Clave's decision. The consul is not a tyrant who can impose her choices on the unwilling. Usually I would say that was a good thing, but I will tell you, for a long time, I wished I could be a tyrant."
"Why not resign, then?" "I didn't trust who might come after me," said Gia simply. "The coal piece was very popular. If the consul who followed me wished to, they could separate Aline from Helen. And though I want my daughter home, I don't want her heartbroken. They could do worse, too. They could try Aline and Helen as traitors, turn Helen's sentence of exile into one of death. Maybe Aline's as well. Anything was possible."
Her gaze was dark and heavy.
"I remain where I am to stand between my daughter and the Clave's darker forces."
"Then aren't we on the same side?" Diana said. "Don't we want the same thing?"
Gia gave a flat smile.
"What separates us, Diana, is 5 years. 5 years of me trying everything to get the Council to reconsider. Helen is their example. Their way of saying to the fair folk, 'Look, we take the cold piece so seriously we even punish our own. Every time the issue comes up for a vote, I am voted down.'"
"But what if other circumstances presented themselves?"
"What other circumstances did you have in mind?"
Diana rolled her shoulders back, feeling the tension prickle along her spine.
"Jace Herondale and Clary Fairchild were dispatched to Faerie for a mission," she said. It was half a guess, while the two of them had been at the Institute, she had glimpsed the contents of their bags. Both had been packed with iron and salt.
Yes, said Gia. We have received several messages since they left.
Then they've told you, said Diana,
about the blight on the Unseelie King's lands.
Gia sat arrested, one hand hovering over her desk.
No one knows what they told me but the Inquisitor and myself, she said.
How did you know?
It doesn't matter.
I'm telling you because I need you to believe that I know what I'm talking about, said Diana. I know that the Unseelie King hates Nephilim, and that he has uncovered some force, some magic, that renders our powers useless. He has made it so that there are parts of his kingdom where runes do not work, where seraph blades will not light.
Gia frowned.
Jason Clary didn't mention anything so specific, and they've had no contact with anyone but me since they entered Faerie.
There is a boy, said Diana. A fairy, a messenger from the Seelie court, Kieran. He's also a prince of Unseelie. He knows some of what his father plans. He's willing to testify in front of the council.
Gia looked bewildered.
An Unseelie prince would testify for the Seelie court? And what is the Seelie court's interest?
The Seelie queen hates the Unseelie king, said Diana. More, apparently, than she hates shadow hunters. She is willing to commit the forces of her army to defeating the Unseelie King, to wiping out his power and reversing the blight on his lands.
Out of the kindness of her heart, Gia raised an eyebrow.
In exchange for the end of the cold peace, said Diana.
Gia gave a short bark of laughter.
No one will agree to that. The Clave...
Everyone is sick of the cold peace, except the most extreme bigots, said Diana. And I don't think either of us want to see them gain power.
Gia sighed. You mean the Dearborns and the cohort.
I spent quite a bit of time with Zara Dearborn and her Centaurian friends at the Institute, said Diana. Her views are not pleasant.
Gia stood up, turning toward the window.
She and her father seek to return the Clave to a lost golden age, a time that never was, when Downworlders knew their place, and Nephilim ruled in harmony. In truth, that past was a violent time, when Downworlders suffered, and those Nephilim who possessed compassion and empathy were tormented and punished along with them.
How many of them are there? Diana asked.
The cohort.
Zara's father, Horace Dearborn, is the unofficial leader, said Gia. His wife is dead, and he has raised his daughter to follow in his footsteps. If he succeeds in placing himself at the head of the Los Angeles Institute, she will rule from beside him. Then there are other families, the Larkspears, the Bridgestocks, the Crossgills. They're scattered around the world. And their goal is to continue restricting downworlder rights, registering them all, giving them numbers.
Forbidding their marriages to shadow hunters, Diana shrugged.
It's all part of a peace, isn't it? First you number people, then you restrict their rights and break up their marriages, then...
No, Gia's voice was gritty. We can't let this happen.
But you don't understand. Zara's being put forth as the great new shadow hunter of her generation, the new Jace Herondale, since she killed Malcolm.
Diana bolted up out of her chair.
That lying girl did not kill Malcolm.
We know Emma didn't, she said. He returned.
I am aware of exactly how he died, said Diana. He raised Annabel Blackthorne from the dead. She killed him.
What? Gia sounded shocked.
It's the truth, Consul.
Diana, you would need proof that what you're saying is true. A trial by mortal sword.
Diana's greatest fear.
No, she said.
It wouldn't be just my secrets I'd be revealing. It would be Julian's, Emma's. They'd all be ruined.
You must see how this looks, Gia said, as if you're seeking a way to keep the Los Angeles Institute under your control by discrediting the Dearborns.
They discredit themselves. Diana looked hard at Gia.
You know, Zara, she said.
Do you really think she killed Malcolm?
No, Gia said after a pause. I don't.
She went to an ornate carved cabinet against one wall of her office. She slid open a drawer. I need time to think about this, Diana. In the meantime, she drew out a thick, cream-colored folder full of papers. This is Zara Dearborn's report on the death of Malcolm Fade and the attacks on the L.A. Institute. Perhaps you can find some discrepancies that might discredit her story. Thank you, Diana took the folder. And the council meeting? A chance for Kieran to give testimony? I'll discuss it with the Inquisitor. Gia suddenly looked even older than she had before. Go home, Diana. I'll summon you tomorrow.
We should have brought Drew, Livy said, standing inside the gates of Blackthorn Hall. This is every horror movie fantasy she's ever had come true.
Blackthorn Hall turned out to be in a suburb of London, not far from the Thames River. The area around it was ordinary. Red brick houses, bus stops plastered with movie posters, kids riding by on bicycles. After days trapped in the Institute, even the foreignness of London felt to Kit like waking up to reality after a dream. Blackthorn Hall was glamoured, which meant that mundanes couldn't see it. Kit had a sort of double vision when he glanced at it for the first time. He could see a pleasant but dull-looking private park, superimposed over a massive house with towering walls and gates, its stones blackened by years of rain and neglect. He squinted hard. The park vanished, and only the house remained. It loomed overhead. It looked to Kit a little like a Greek temple, with columns holding up the arched portico in front of a set of double doors, massive and made from the same metal as the fence that ran all the way around the property. It was high, tipped with sharp points. The only entrance was a gate, which Ty made short work of with one of his runes.
"What's that one mean?" Kit had asked, pointing as the gate creaked open with a puff of rust.
Ty looked at him. "Open." "I was going to guess that," Kit muttered as they headed inside. Now, within the property, he gazed around in wonder. The gardens might have fallen into disrepair now, but you could see where there had been rose arbors and marble balustrades holding up massive stone jugs spilling flowers and weeds. There were wildflowers everywhere. It was beautiful in its own odd, ruined way. The house was like a small castle. The circlet of thorns that Kit recognized as the Blackthorn family symbol stamped into the metal front doors and onto the tops of columns.
"Looks haunted," said Livy as they went up the front steps.
In the distance, Kit could see the pitch-black circle of an old ornamental pond. Around it were a set of marble benches. A single statue of a man in a toga regarded him with blank, worried eyes.
"There used to be a whole collection of statues of different Greek and Roman playwrights and poets here," said Livy, as Ty went to work on the doors. "Uncle Arthur had most of them shipped to the L.A. Institute."
"The open rune's not working," said Ty, straightening up and looking at Kit as if he knew everything Kit was thinking, as if he knew everything Kit had ever thought. There was something about being the focus of Tiberius's gaze that was frightening and thrilling all at once. "We have to figure another way in." Ty pushed past Kit and his sister, heading down the stairs. They made their way around the side of the hall, down a pebbled path. Hedges that had probably once been neat and clipped curved away in explosions of leaves and flowers. In the far distance, the water of the Thames shimmered.
"Maybe there's a way in through the back," Livy said. "The windows can't be that secure either."
"What about this door?" Kit pointed. Ty turned around, frowning.
"What door?"
"Here," Kit said, puzzled. He could see the door very clearly. A tall, narrow entrance with an odd symbol carved into it. He placed his hand on the old wood. It felt rough and warm under his fingers.
"Don't you see it?"
"I see it now," Livy said. "But I swear it wasn't there a second ago."
"Some kind of doubled glamour," Ty said, coming up beside Kit.
He had pulled up the hood of his sweater, and his face was a pale oval in between the black of his hair and the darkness of his collar. But why would Kit be able to see it?
Maybe because I'm used to seeing glamours at the shadow market, said Kit.
Glamours that aren't made by shadow hunters, said Libby.
Glamours that aren't meant for shadow hunters to see through, said Kit.
Ty looked thoughtful.
There was an opaqueness to him sometimes that made it hard for Kit to tell whether Ty agreed with him or not. He did, however, put his steely to the door and began to draw the open rune. It wasn't the lock that clicked, but the hinges that popped open. They jumped out of the way as the door half fell, half sagged to the side, slamming into the wall with an echoing sound.
"Don't press down so hard when you draw," Libby said to Ty. He shrugged.
The space beyond the door was dark enough for the twins to need to spark up their witch lights. The glow of them had a pearlescent whitish tint that Kit found strangely beautiful. They were in an old hallway filled with dust and the webs of scuttling spiders. Ty went ahead of Kit and Livy behind him. He suspected they were protecting him and resented it, but knew they wouldn't understand his protest if he lodged one. They went down the hall and up a long, narrow staircase, at the end of which was the rotted remains of a door. Through the door was a massive room with a hanging chandelier.
"Probably a ballroom," Livy said, her voice echoing oddly in the space. "Look, this part of the house is better taken care of."
It was. The ballroom was empty but clean, and as they moved through the other rooms, they found furniture shrouded in dropcloths, windows boarded carefully to protect the glass, boxes stacked in the halls. Inside the boxes were cloths and the strong smell of mothballs. Livy coughed and waved a hand in front of her face.
"There's got to be a library," Ty said. "Somewhere they would keep family documents."
"I can't believe our dad might have visited here when he was growing up," Livy led the way down the hall, her body casting an elongated shadow. Long hair, long legs, shimmering witch light in her hand.
"He didn't live here?"
Kit asked. Livy shook her head.
"Grew up in Cornwall, not London, but he went to school in Idris."
Idris. Kit had read more about Idris in the London Institute Library. The fabled homeland of the shadow hunters. A place of green forests and high mountains, icy cold lakes, and a city of glass towers. He had to admit that the part of him that loved fantasy movies and Lord of the Rings yearned to see it. He told that part of himself to be quiet. Idris was shadow hunter business, and he hadn't yet decided he wanted to be a shadow hunter. In fact, he was quite, nearly totally, sure he didn't.
"Library," Ty said. It occurred to Kit that Ty never used five words when one would do. He was standing in front of the door to a hexagonal room. The walls beside him hung with paintings of ships. Some were cocked at odd angles as if they were plunging up or down waves. The library walls were painted dark blue. The only art in the room, a marble statue of a man's head and shoulders, sitting atop a stone column. There was a massive desk and multiple drawers that turned out to be disappointingly empty. Forays behind the bookshelves and under the rug also turned up nothing but dust balls.
"Maybe we should try another room," Kit said, emerging from under an escritoire with dust in his blonde hair.
Ty shook his head, looking frustrated. "There's something in here. I have a feeling."
Kit wasn't sure Sherlock Holmes operated on feelings, but he didn't say anything, just straightened up. As he did, he caught sight of a piece of paper sticking out of the edge of the small writing desk. He pulled at it, and it came away. It was old paper, worn almost to transparency. Kit blinked. On it was written his name. Not his name, but his last name, Herondale. Over and over. Entwined with another name, so that the two words formed looping patterns. The other word was Blackthorn. A deep sense of unease shot through him. He tucked the paper quickly into his jeans pocket, just as Ty said, "Move, Kit. I want to get a closer look at that bust."
To Kit, bust only meant one thing. But since the only breast in the room belonged to Ty's sister, he stepped aside with alacrity.
Ty strode over to the small statue on the marble column. He'd pulled his hood down, and his hair stood up around his head, soft as the downy feathers of a black swan. Ty touched a small placard below the carving. "The difficulty is not so great to die for a friend as to find a friend worth dying for," he said. "Homer," said Livy. Whatever kind of education the Shadow Hunters got, Kit had to admit, it was thorough. "Apparently," said Ty, pulling a dagger out of his belt. A second later, he'd driven the blade into the carved eye socket of the statue. Livy yelped.
"Ty, what?"
Her brother yanked the blade back out and repeated the action on the statue's second eye socket. This time something round and glimmering popped out of the hole in the plaster with an audible crack. Ty caught it in his left hand. He grinned, and the grin changed his face completely. Ty, when he was still and expressionless, had an intensity that fascinated Kit. When he was smiling, he was extraordinary. "What did you find?" Livy darted across the room, and they gathered around Tiberius, who was holding out a many-faceted crystal, the size of a child's hand.
"And how did you know it was there?"
"When you said Homer's name," said Ty, "I recalled that he was blind. He's almost always depicted with his eyes shut or with a cloth blindfold. But this statue had open eyes. I looked a little closer and saw that the bust was marble, but the eyes were plaster. After that, it was..."
"Elementary," said Kit.
"You know Holmes never says elementary, my dear Watson, in the books," said Ty.
"I swear I've seen it in the movies," Kit said, "or maybe on TV."
"Who would ever want movies or TV when there are books?" said Ty with disdain.
"Could someone here pay attention?"
Livy demanded, her ponytail swinging in exasperation.
"What is that thing you found, Ty?"
"An Alethea crystal." He held it up so it caught the glow of his sister's witchlight.
"Look."
Kit glanced at the faceted surface of the stone. To his surprise, a face flashed across it, like an image seen in a dream. A woman's face, clouded around with long, dark hair.
"Oh!" Livy clapped her hand over her mouth. "She looks a little like me, but how?"
"An Alethea crystal is a way of capturing or transporting memories. I think this one is of Annabelle," said Ty.
"Alethea is Greek," said Livy. "She was the Greek goddess of truth," said Kit.
He shrugged when they stared at him. "Ninth grade book report." Ty's mouth crooked at the corner.
"Very good, Watson."
"Don't call me Watson," Kit said. Ty ignored this.
"We need to figure out how to access what's trapped in this crystal," he said, "as quickly as possible. It would help Julian and Emma."
"You don't know how to get into it?" Kit asked.
Ty shook his head, clearly disgruntled.
"It's not Shadowhunter magic. We don't learn other kinds. It's forbidden." This struck Kit as a stupid rule. How were you ever supposed to know how your enemies operated if you made it forbidden to learn about them?
"We should go," Livy said, hovering in the doorway. "It's starting to get dark. Demon time."
Kit glanced toward the window. The sky was darkening, the stain of twilight spreading across the blue. The shadows were coming down over London.
"I have an idea," he said. "Why don't we take it to the shadow market here?
I know my way around the market. I can find a warlock or even a witch to help us get whatever's in that thing." The twins glanced at each other. Both were clearly hesitant.
"We're not really supposed to go to shadow markets," said Livy.
"So tell them I ran off there and you had to catch me," said Kit. "If you ever have to explain, which you won't." Neither of them spoke, but Kit could see curiosity in Ty's gray eyes.
"Come on," he said, pitching his voice low, the way his father had taught him, the tone you used when you wanted to convince people you really meant something.
"When you're home, Julian never lets you go anywhere. Now's your chance. Haven't you always wanted to see a shadow market?"
Livy broke first.
"Okay," she said, casting a quick look at her brother to see if he agreed with her. "Okay, if you know where it is."
Ty's pale face lit with excitement. Kit felt the same spark transfer to him. The shadow market, his home, his sanctuary, the place he'd been raised.
trailing around after demons and artifacts with Livy and Ty. They were the ones who knew everything, while he knew nothing. But at the shadow market, he could shine. He'd shock them, impress them. And then, maybe, he'd cut and run away. The shadows were lengthening by the time Julian and Emma finished their lunch. Julian bought some food and supplies at a small grocer shop, while Emma darted next door to pick up pajamas and T-shirts at a small New Age shop that sold tarot cards and crystal gnomes. When she emerged, she was grinning. She produced a blue and purple T-shirt emblazoned with a smiling unicorn for Jules, who stared at it in horror. She tucked it into his pack carefully before they started across the town to find the beginning of the path that led up and around the coast. The hills sloped up steeply from the water. It wasn't an easy climb. Marked only as to the cliffs, the path wound up through the outskirts of town and the precariously perched houses, all of which looked as if they might at any moment tumble down into the Half Moon Harbor. Shadow hunters were trained for much more than this kind of exertion, though, and they made good time. Soon they were out of the town proper and walking up a narrow path, the hill rising farther on their right, falling down toward the sea on their left. The sea itself was luminous deep blue, glowing like a lamp. Clouds the color of seashells twined across the sky. It was beautiful in a completely different way than the sunset over the Pacific. Instead of the stark colors of sea and desert, everything here was soft pastels, greens, blues, and pinks. What was stark was the cliffs themselves. They were climbing closer to the chapel part of Chapel Cliff, the rock promontory that jutted out into the ocean, the spikes of gray stone that crowned it, ominously black against the rosy sky. The hill was gone. They were out on the spit of the land itself. Long gray slate shingles that looked like a pack of playing cards shuffled and then scattered, tumbled steeply away on either side, down toward the sea. The house that they had seen from town was nestled among the rocks, the spiked crown of the stone chapel rising behind it. As Emma neared it, she felt the force of its glamour almost as a wall pushing her back. Jules had slown too. "There's a placard here," he said. "Says this place belongs to the National Trust. No trespassers." Emma made a face. "No trespassers usually means the local kids have made it into a hangout, and the whole place is covered with empty candy wrappers and booze bottles." "I don't know. The glamour here is really strong. It's not just visual, but emotional. You can feel it, right?" Emma nodded. The cottage was giving off waves of stay away and danger and nothing here you want to see. It was a bit like being shouted at by an angry stranger on a bus. "Take my hand," Julian said. "What?" She turned in surprise. He was holding his hand out. She could see the faint smatter of colored pencil on his skin. He flexed his fingers. "We can get through this better together," he said. "Concentrate on pushing it back." Emma took his hand, accepting the shock that went through her at his touch. His skin was warm and soft, rough where there were calluses. He tightened his fingers around hers. They moved forward past the gate and onto the path leading up to the front door. Emma imagined the glamour as a curtain, as something she could touch. She imagined drawing it aside. It was hard, like lifting a weight with her mind, but strength flowed through her from Julian, through her fingers and wrist, up her arm, and into her heart and lungs. Her concentration snapped into focus. Almost casually, she let herself draw the glamour away, lifting it lightly aside. The cottage sprang into clearer view. The windows weren't boarded up at all, but clean and whole, the front door freshly painted a bright blue. Even the knob looked recently polished to a shiny bronze. Julian took hold of it and pushed, and the door swung open, welcoming them inside. The sense of something ordering them away from the cottage was gone. Emma let go of Julian's hand and stepped inside. It was too dark to see. She took her witch light out of her pocket and let its light rise up and around them. Julian, behind her, gave a low whistle of surprise.
This doesn't look deserted, not by a long shot. It was a small, pretty room. A wooden four-poster bed stood beneath a window with a view out to the village below. Furniture that looked as if it had been hand-painted in blues, grays, and soft seaside colors was scattered out among a profusion of rag rugs. Two walls were taken up by a kitchen with all the modern conveniences, a coffee maker, a stove, a dishwasher, and granite-top counters. Neat stacks of firewood rose on either side of a stone-bound fireplace. Two doors led off to the main room. Emma investigated and found a small office with a hand-painted desk and a blue-tiled bathroom with a tub and a shower and a basin sink. She turned the shower faucets, half in disbelief, and yelped as water sprayed her. Everything seemed to be completely in working order, as if someone who lived in the cottage and took loving care of it had only just left. "We might as well stay here," Emma said, returning to the living room where Julian had flicked on the electric lights. "Way ahead of you, Carstairs," he said, opening a kitchen cabinet and starting to put the groceries away. "Nice place, no rent, and it'll be easier to search if we're here anyway." Emma set her witchlight down on the table and looked around wonderingly. "I know this seems far-fetched," she said, "but do you think Malcolm had a secret second life as a renter of adorably furnished holiday cottages?" "Or," Julian said, "there's an even stronger glamour on this place than we realized, and it only looks like an adorably furnished holiday cottage, while actually it's a hole in the ground full of rats." Emma threw herself down on the bed. The blanket felt like a cloud, and the mattress was heavenly after the lumpy one in the London Institute. "Best rats ever," she announced, glad they weren't going to have to stay in a bed and breakfast after all. "Imagine their tiny, furry bodies wriggling around you." Julian had turned back and was facing her, a half-grin on his face. When Emma had been small, she'd been horrified by rats and rodents. She sat up and glared at him. "Why are you trying to ruin my good time?" "Well, to be fair, this isn't a holiday. Not for us. This is a mission. We're supposed to be looking for anything that might give us an idea where Annabelle might have gone." "I don't know," Emma said. "This place looks like it's been stripped down and totally renovated. It was built so long ago. How do we know what's left of the original house? And wouldn't Malcolm have taken anything that was important to him to his house in L.A.?" "Not necessarily. I think this cottage was special to him." Julian hooked his thumbs through the belt loops of his jeans. "Look at the way he's taken care of it. This house is personal. It feels like a home. Not like that glass and steel thing he lived in L.A. "Then I guess we should start looking around." Emma tried to sound excited at the prospect, but she felt exhausted. No sleep the night before, the long trip on the train, her worry about Christina had all sapped her energy. Julian looked at her critically. "I'll make tea," he said. "That'll help." She crinkled her nose at him. "Tea? Tea is your solution? You're not even really British. You spent 2 months in England. How did they brainwash you? You don't like coffee, and you need caffeine." "I get my caffeine the way right-thinking people get it." Emma threw up her hands and stalked into the office. "From chocolate." She began to pull the drawers out of the desk. They were empty. She examined the bookshelves. Nothing interesting there, either. She started across the room to the closet and heard something creak. She turned back and knelt down, shoving the rag rug out of the way. The floor was stripped oak. Just under the rug was a square of lighter wood, and the faint black lines of seaming where the square outline of a trapdoor was visible. Emma took her steely out and placed its tip against it. "Open," she whispered, drawing the rune. There was a tearing sound. The square of wood ripped away and crumbled into chunks of sawdust, tumbling into the hole she'd uncovered. It was slightly bigger on all sides than she'd thought. In it were several small books and a large, leather-bound tome that Emma squinted at in puzzlement. Was it some kind of spell book? "Did you just blow something up?"
Julian came in, his cheek smeared with something black. He glanced over Emma's shoulder and whistled. "Your classic secret floor compartment. Help me kick this stuff out. You get the giant book." Emma picked up the three smaller volumes. They were all bound in worn leather with a stamped MFB on the spines, their pages rough-edged.
"It's not a book," Julian said in a slightly odd voice. "It's a portfolio."
He retrieved it and carried it into the living room, Emma hurrying after him. Two steaming cups of tea stood on the kitchen island, and a fire was blazing away. Emma realized that the black stuff on Julian's face was probably ash. She pictured him kneeling here, starting a fire for them, patient and thoughtful, and felt a wave of overwhelming tenderness for him. He was already standing at the island, gently opening the portfolio. He caught his breath. The first picture was a watercolor of Chapel Cliff, seen from a distance. The colors and shapes leapt out vividly. Emma could feel the cool sea air on her neck, hear the cry of the gulls.
"It's lovely," she said, sitting down opposite him on a tall stool. "Annabelle did it." He touched her signature on the right-hand corner. "I had no idea she was an artist."
"I guess art runs in your blood," Emma said. Julian didn't look up. He was turning the pages with careful, almost reverent hands. There were many more seascapes. Annabelle seemed to have loved capturing the ocean and the curves of the land that bordered it. Annabelle had also drawn dozens of pictures of the Blackthorn Manor House in Idris, lingering on the softness of its golden stone, the beauty of its gardens, the vines of thorns that wrapped the gates. "Like the mural on the wall of your room," Emma wanted to say to Julian, but she didn't. Julian's hand stopped on none of those, though. He paused instead on a sketch that was unmistakably of the cottage they were in at that moment. A wooden fence surrounded it, and Polperro was visible in the distance, the warren crawling up the opposite hill crowded with houses. Malcolm leaned against the fence, looking impossibly young. He clearly had not yet stopped aging. Though it was a pencil sketch, somehow the drawing caught the fairness of his hair, the oddity of his eyes. But they had been rendered in such loving lines that he looked beautiful. He seemed about to smile. "I think that they lived here 200 years ago, probably in hiding from the clave," Julian said. "There's something about a place you've been with someone you love. It takes on a meaning in your mind. It becomes more than a place. It becomes a distillation of what you felt for each other. The moments you spend in a place with someone, they become part of the bricks and mortar, part of its soul." The firelight touched the side of his face, his hair, turning them gold. Emma felt tears rise in the back of her throat and fought them back. "There's a reason Malcolm didn't just let this place fall into ruins. He loved it. He cared about it because it was a place he'd been with her." Emma picked up her tea. "And maybe a place he wanted to bring her back to," she said, "after he raised her." "Yes. I think Malcolm raised Annabelle's body nearby, that he planned to hide with her here, the way he had so long ago." Julian seemed to shake off the intense mood that had come on him, like a wet dog shaking water off its fur. "There's some guidebooks to Cornwall on the shelves. I'll go through them. What have you got there? What's in the books?" Emma opened the first one. "Diary of Malcolm Fade Blackthorn, age 8, was scrawled on the inside cover. "By the angels," she said. "His diaries." She began to read out loud from the first page. "My name is Malcolm Fade Blackthorn. I chose the first two names myself, but the last was given to me to use by the Blackthorns, who have kindly taken me in. Felix says I am a ward, though I don't understand what that means. He also says I am a warlock. When he says it, I think it is probably not a good thing to be. But Annabelle says not to worry, that we are all born what we are and can't change it. Annabelle says..." She broke off. This was the man who'd murdered her parents, but it was also a child's voice, helpless and wondering, echoing down through the centuries. 200 years. The diary wasn't dated, but it must have been written in the early 1800s. "Annabelle says," she whispered, "he fell in love with her so early." Julian cleared his throat and stood up. Looks like it, he said. We'll have to search the diary for mentions of places that were important to both of them.
It's a lot of diary, she said, glancing at the three volumes.
Then I guess we've got a lot of reading ahead of us, said Julian.
I'd better make more tea.
Emma's wail of,
not tea,
followed him into the kitchen. The London Shadow Market was located at the southern end of London Bridge. Kit was disappointed to find that London Bridge was just a dull concrete edifice without towers.
I thought it would be more like it is in the postcards, he lamented.
You're thinking of Tower Bridge,
Livy informed him archly as they began scrambling down a set of narrow stone steps to reach the space below the London Bridge railway lines, which crisscrossed overhead.
That's the one in all the pictures. The real London Bridge was knocked down a long time ago. This one's the modern replacement.
A sign advertised some kind of daytime fruit and vegetable market, but that had long since closed. The white painted stalls were battened down tightly, the gates locked. The shadow of Suffolk Cathedral loomed over it all, a bulk of glass and stone that blocked their view of the river.
Kit blinked away the glamour as he reached the bottom of the steps. The image tore like spider webs, and the shadow market burst into life. They were still using many of the ordinary market's stalls, clever, he thought, to hide in plain sight like that. But they were brightly colored now, a rainbow of paint and shimmer. Tents billowed in between the stalls as well, made of silks and draperies, signs floating beside their openings, advertising everything from fortune-telling to luck charms to love spells. They slipped into the bustling crowd. Stalls sold enchanted masks, bottles of vintage blood for vampires. Livy looked like she was going to gag over the red-hot cherry flavor variety, and apothecaries did a brisk trade in magical powders and tinctures. A werewolf with thin, pale white hair sold bottles of silvery powder, while across from him a witch whose skin had been tattooed with multicolored scales was hawking spell books. Several stands were taken up with selling Shadow Hunter repelling charms, which made Livy giggle. Kit was less amused.
Push your sleeves down, he said, and pull your hoods up. Cover your marks as much as you can.
Livy and Ty did as they were told. Ty reached for his headphones, too, but paused. Slowly, he looped them back around his neck.
I should keep them off, he said. I might need to hear something.
Livy squeezed his shoulder and said something to him in a low voice that Kit couldn't hear. Ty shook his head, waving her away, and they pushed farther into the market. A group of pale-skinned knights' children had gathered at a stall advertising willing victims here. A crowd of humans sat around a deal table, chatting. Occasionally, another vampire would come up, money would change hands, and one of the humans would be drawn into the shadows to be bitten. Livy made a smothered noise.
They're very careful, Kit assured her. There's a place like this in the L.A. market. The vamps never drink enough to hurt anyone.
He wondered if he should say something else reassuring to Ty. The dark-haired boy was pale, with a fine sheen of sweat along his cheekbones. His hands were opening and closing at his sides. Farther along was a stall advertising a raw bar. Werewolves surrounding a dozen fresh carcasses of animals, selling bloody hunks torn off in fistfuls by passing customers.
Livy frowned. Ty said nothing.
Kit had noticed before that puns and language jokes didn't interest Ty much. And right now, Ty looked as if he were struggling between trying to take in the details of the market and not throwing up.
Put your headphones on, Livy murmured to him. It's all right.
Ty shook his head again. His black hair was sticking to his forehead. Kit frowned. He wanted to grab Ty and drag him out of the market to somewhere it would be calm and quiet. He remembered Ty saying that he hated crowds, that the sheer noise and confusion was like broken glass in my head. There was something else, too, something odd and off about this market.
I think we've wandered into the food area, said Livy, making a face. I wish we hadn't.
This way. Kit turned more toward the cathedral. Usually there was a section of the market where warlocks grouped together.
So far he'd only seen vampires, werewolves, witches, and... He slowed almost to a stop. No fairies, he said.
What?
Livy asked, nearly bumping into him. The market is usually full of fairies, he said. They sell everything from invisibility clothes to sacks of food that are never empty. But I haven't seen a single one here.
I have, said Ty. He pointed.
Nearby was a large stall manned by a tall male witch with long braided gray hair. In front of the stall was a green baize table. Displayed on the table were antique bird cages made of white-painted wrought iron. Each one was quite pretty in its own right, and for a moment Kit thought that they were what was for sale. Then he looked closer. Inside each cage was a small, trapped creature. An assortment of pixies, nixies, brownies, and even a goblin, whose wide eyes were nearly swollen shut, probably from so much proximity to cold iron. The other fairies were chatting mournfully and softly, their hands seizing at the bars, then falling away with low cries of pain. Ty was white with distress. His hands trembled against his sides. Kit thought of Ty in the desert, stroking the small lizards, putting mice in his pockets, capturing weasels for company. Ty, whose heart went out to small and helpless living things. We can't leave them like that.
They're probably selling them for blood and bones, said Livy, her voice shaking. We have to do something.
You have no authority here, Shadow Hunter. A cool, clipped voice spun them around. A woman stood before them. Her skin was dark as mahogany, her hair like bronze and dressed high on her head. The pupils of her eyes were shaped like golden stars. She was dressed in a glacier-white pantsuit with high, sparkling heels. She could have been any age from 18 to 30. She smiled when they looked at her.
Yes, I recognize a shadow hunter, even those clumsily hiding their marks, she said. I suggest you leave the market before someone less friendly than I am notices you.
Both the twins made subtle gestures toward their weapons belts, their hands hovering near the hilts of their serif blades. Kit knew this was his moment to show how well he could handle a market and its denizens, not to mention preventing a bloodbath.
I am an emissary of Barnabas Hale, he said, of the Los Angeles market. These shadow hunters are under my protection. Who are you?
Hypatia Vex, she said. I co-run this market.
She narrowed her starry eyes at Kit.
A representative of Barnabas, you say. Why should I believe you?
The only people who know about Barnabas Hale, said Kit, are people he wants to know. She nodded slightly.
And the shadow hunters? Barnabas sent them, too?
He needs me to consult a warlock regarding a peculiar magical object, said Kit. He was flying high now, high on the lies and the trickery and the con. They have it in their possession.
Very well, then. If Barnabas sent you to consult a warlock, which warlock is it?
It was me. A deep voice spoke from the shadows. Kit turned to see a figure standing in front of a large, dark green tent. It had been a male voice, but otherwise the figure was too covered. Massive robe, cloak, hood, and gloves, to discern gender.
I'll take this, Hypatia.
Hypatia blinked slowly. It was like the stars vanishing and then reappearing from behind a cloud.
If you insist.
She made as if to turn and stalk away, then paused, looking back over her shoulder at Livy and Ty.
If you pity those creatures, those fairies, dying inside their cages, she said. Think of this. If it were not for the cold peace your people insisted on, they would not be here. Look to the blood on your own hands, shadow hunters.
She disappeared between two tents. Ty's expression was full of distress.
But my hands... It's an expression.
Livy put her arm around her twin, hugging him tightly to her side.
It's not your fault, Ty. She's just being cruel.
We should go. Kit said to the robed and hooded warlock, who nodded.
Come with me, he said, and slipped into his tent. The rest of them followed.
The inside of the tent was remarkably clean and plain, with a wooden floor, a simple cot bed,
and several shelves filled with books, maps, bottles of powder, candles in different colors, and jars of alarming colored liquids. Tai exhaled, leaning back against one of the tent poles. Relief was printed clearly on his face as he basked in the relative calm and quiet. Kit wanted to go over to Tai and ask him if he was all right after the cacophony of the market, but Livy was already there, brushing the sweat-damp hair off her brother's forehead. Tai nodded, said something to her Kit couldn't hear. "Come," said the warlock. "Sit down with me." He gestured. In the center of the room was a small table surrounded by chairs. The shadow hunter sat down, and the hooded warlock settled opposite them. In the flickering light inside the tent, Kit could glimpse the edge of a mask behind the hood, obscuring the warlock's face. "You may call me Shade," he said. "It's not my last name, but it will do."
"Why did you lie for us?" Livy said. "Out there. You don't have any agreement with Barnabas Hale."
"Oh, I have a few," said Shade. "Not regarding you, to be fair, but I do know the man. And I'm curious that you do. Not many shadow hunters are even aware of his name."
"I'm not a shadow hunter," said Kit.
"Oh, you are," said Shade. "You're that new Herondale, to be exact." Livy's voice was sharp.
"How did you know that? Tell us now."
"Because of your face," he said to Kit. "Your pretty, pretty face. You're not the first Herondale I've met, not even the first with those eyes, like distilled twilight. I don't know why you only have one mark, but I certainly can make a guess." He templed his hands under his chin. Kit thought he saw a gleam of green skin at his wrist, just below the edge of his glove. "I have to say, I never thought I'd have the pleasure of entertaining the lost Herondale."
"I'm not all that entertained, actually," said Kit. "We could put on a movie."
Livy leaned forward.
"Sorry," she said. "He gets like this when he's uncomfortable, sarcastic."
"Who knew that was an inherited trait?" Shade held out a gloved hand. "Now, show me what you brought. I assume that wasn't a lie."
Tai reached into his jacket and brought out the Alethea crystal. In the candlelight, it glittered more than ever. Shade chuckled.
"A memory holder," he said.
"It looks like you might get your movie after all."
He reached out, and after a moment's hesitation, Tai allowed him to take it. Shade set the crystal delicately in the center of the table. He passed a hand over it, then frowned and removed his glove. As Kit had thought, the skin of the hand he revealed was deep green. He wondered why Shade would bother covering something like that up here in the shadow market, where warlocks were commonplace. Shade passed his bare hand over the crystal and murmured. The candles in the room began to gutter. His murmuring increased. Kit recognized the words as Latin, which he'd taken 3 months of in school, before he decided there was no point in knowing a language he couldn't converse in with anyone but the Pope, who he was unlikely to meet. He had to admit now that it had weight to it, though, a sense that each word was freighted with a deeper meaning. The candles went out entirely, but the room wasn't dark. The crystal was glowing, brighter and brighter under Shade's touch. At last, a focused beam of light seemed to explode from it, and Kit realized what Shade had meant when he joked about a movie. The light worked like the beam of a projector, casting moving images against the dark wall of the tent. A girl sat bound to a chair inside a circular room filled with benches, a sort of auditorium. Through the windows of the room, Kit could see mountains covered in snow. Though it was likely winter, the girl was wearing only a white shift dress. Her feet were bare, and her long, dark hair hung in tangles. Her face was remarkably like Livy's, so much so that to see it twisted in agony and terror made Kit tense.
"Annabel Blackthorne,"
a slight man with bent shoulders entered the scene. He was dressed in black. He wore a pin, not unlike Diego's, clasped at his shoulder. His hood was drawn up. Because of that, and the angle of the crystal's viewpoint, it was hard to see his face or body in much detail.
"The Inquisitor," muttered Shade. He was a centurion back then.
"You have come before us," the man went on, "accused of consorting with downworlders. Your family took